The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
If you stop to listen, you can hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith.
We're opposing this open pit lithium mine that threatens the water, threatens the air, that threatens to displace a lot of ecosystems. And the fight that we are trying to push forward is the human being fight. We all share this land together. We all drink the same water. We all breathe the same air. And the difference between the reality of it and the actuality of it, because there's a thin line, and the reality of this thing is it's going to poison the water, it's going to take from the land, what's left of it is going to be a big pit in the ground.
Today on American Indian Airwaves, protecting Pahimaha from the possible construction of the Thacker Pass lithium mine in northwest Nevada. If built, it would be the largest lithium supply mine in the United States, and we'll speak with an indigenous scientist who worked on the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 6 assessment report that was published recently this year. All that and more in protecting Mother Earth here on American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone Makani blows to the bahu drum. It's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
In the first segment of our program today here on American Indian Airwaves, we go to the heart of the Paiute Shoshone and surrounding indigenous nations in northwest Nevada on protecting Pahimaha from the possible construction of the Thacker Pass lithium mine in northwestern Nevada. The people of the Red Mountain are an indigenous-led organization comprised of Paiute and Shoshone peoples from Fort McDermitt and surrounding indigenous nations and supporters working to protect this sacred site from the possible construction of the Thacker Pass lithium mine. If built, the mine would be the United States' largest source of lithium supply, generating over 60,000 metric tons of battery-grade lithium carbonate annually. The people of the Red Mountain are calling for support in demanding that the U.S. Department of Interior to rescind the Thacker Pass lithium mine project's final environmental impact statement, record of decision, and plan of operations. Lithium Nevada Corporation is a subsidiary of the Canadian corporation Lithium Americas Corp, which proposes to build the open-pit lithium mine with a project area of approximately 18,000 acres that will use approximately 5,200 acre-feet per year of water, which is equivalent to an average pumping rate of over 3,200 gallons per minute in one of the driest regions of the nation. Lithium Nevada Corporation characterizes the mine project as a green project, despite estimates that the mine will produce an estimated 152,000 plus tons of carbon dioxide emissions every year and will cause irreversible harm to the Fort McDermitt, Paiute, and Shoshone Nations, ancestral massacre sites, the water, air, medicines, culturally important wildlife relations, and everything else the land and water culturally sustains for the peoples. The Bureau of Land Management approved the mine back on January 15th of 2021 without adequate consultation of Indigenous citizens and nations. In today's segment, we're joined by guest interviewer Irene Montoyas, who speaks with Gary McKinney and Joshua Dean Jr. The interview starts with Gary McKinney from the Duck Valley Shoshone Paiute Nation and of Fort McDermitt on protecting Pemaha and protecting Mother Earth.
My name is Gary McKinney. I'm from the Western Shoshone people and the Northern Paiute people. Right now I'm standing at Pemaha, one of the many cultural sites out here in Northern Nevada, occupied Paiute lands. Some of the things that led up to this point and us being out here standing is we're opposing this open pit lithium mine that threatens the water, threatens the air, that threatens to displace a lot of ecosystems. And the fight that we are trying to push forward is the human being fight. We all share this land together. We all drink the same water. We all breathe the same air. And the difference between the reality of it and the actuality of it, because there's a thin line. And the reality of this thing is it's going to poison the water. It's going to take from the land. What's left of it is going to be a big pit in the ground. But actually, they're going to tell you that it's okay, that actually, don't worry, that actually there's nothing bad that's going to harm you there. But in reality, we know that there's a balance to this thing. There's a balance to this, the greatest mystery of them all. And as people, as caretakers of the land, as simple human beings, we're put here to live in harmony with one another, with Mother Earth. And our old ones knew that. That knowledge is ancient, just like that water underneath the ground. We don't know how old the water is underneath us. And so we don't know how it's going to react to this new world out here. The lithium processing is done with evaporation of the water, and what's left of under the pool is what they use and process. And we're out in front of it by saying, no, this isn't going to happen, because we have cultural sites out here, sacred sites out here, burial sites, and it means something to us. And it doesn't mean anything to the federal government, because they think that we had funeral services for each passing, and that's not the way that it was done back then. You know, we used this whole land out here before there was borders, state borders, before there was reservations, before there was any of that. We were out here in a place like this, and we gathered, we hunted, we fished, and you know, we lived in harmony on the land. Then somewhere down the line, the actuality of it, of living here on Turtle Island, was the policies, was the lawmakers, and it's them that's telling you, actually, this is something good for us. Actually, we need to do it. Actually, there isn't any cultural sites back there. There is no actual history back there. But in reality, there is. That's where we are. That's our fight. That's the voice that we have, and we're lifting up our ancestors and their knowledge, and we're willing to continue that tradition to protect our land, because we're the caretakers of the land, and we can't allow these high-paying jobs to come in and take advantage of our ecosystems, take advantage of our already small communities, because that we call cultural genocide, and we're aware to that. We're savvy to it, and the one way to decolonize ourselves is to realize that there's a difference between the reality and the actuality of living life over lithium. We will always choose to protect our people and to move one foot in front of the other with the people, for the people. And we don't believe in asking for these government agencies to speak for us, to say it's okay, it's fine, you guys will be all right. But in reality, we're not. 50, 60, 80 years down the road, you know, our unborns may see that birth defect. They might be breathing in more than coronavirus, more than the smoke every summer. And that's the reality of it. That's what we're trying to wake people up to. And there are people who support that. There are still human beings in the world. We don't need electric vehicles. We don't need more batteries. What we need to do is just leave this Mother Earth alone and let her fix herself. Let her find that balance again. And what we will see out of it is the beauty of life. And sometimes, you know, we just need to be simple. We just need to live simple, think simple, and believe less. Because what they want to tell you is, you know, we need this lithium. We need to hurt the land to get it. Until there's these things like government-to-government consultation that isn't happening, they're fast-tracking things so that they can get to this lithium. And it really is a fight now when you're talking about it like that, tug of war. But, you know, our feet are planted firmly underneath us, and just like our ancestors, that's what we want to do, is protect our water, protect our air for our young, for the youth, for the young people, for the unborns. All the way down the line it goes, and we want it to be strong for everybody, not just the indigenous people. We need everybody to be breathing this good air together, witnessing the beauty of this, and not the destruction that man brings. The reality of it is we need to think more and believe less, and that's how we're gonna be able to support. And the people that's wondering, you know, how can I support from out here? You know, just understand that, you know, that we're still fighting this reality, the spiritual reality, and the actuality of what these jobs are telling us. It's not clean. It's not, no way to go. It's, you know, and I believe that the three main reasons for this climate crisis is capitalism, colonialism, and extractivism. And there's a reality and an actuality to all that. And that's what, you know, the people need to do is think. That right there will be enough support that maybe they'll see us and say, hey, you know what? I can stand up for my people. You know what? You know, it is okay to be a human being, to love one another, to take care of these animals, take care of the water, you know, so that we can all thrive and not go under. You know, that's just being real about it and not, you know, greenwashing anything, sugarcoating anything. You know, we need to protect Mother Earth because she protects us. And that's the cycle that cannot be broken. There it is.
Can you let us know what they're telling, what BLM is saying that they're going to use the lithium for?
They say it's electric vehicles, lithium batteries, and they can't do any of the manufacturing right here. They have to network it to different places, different facilities, processing plants. And that's the scary thing. If this goes up, then the rest of them are gonna come flooding in. And there's a lot of cultural sites between here and there. Go ahead. The brother Josh is here and he's with me now, and he wants to chime in right now.
My name is Joshua Dini Sr. I am Western Shoshone, Northern Paiute, Walker River Paiute Tribe. So they have a 5-year grant or money out there for the solar fields. And so a lot of those solar panels are ran off of lithium batteries. So you have big projects like in Vegas. You have big projects that are coming up near Reno, Texas, all over. And so that's why they, you know, are really pushing for these lithium mines. They say it's green energy, but it's not. You know, when those solar panels, when they quit working in what, 5 years, and then what, they gotta replace that. And so I'm here because we have to stand together with our people. You know, I know this is a McDermott area, but our people are nomadic and they traveled, and they say that wherever our people were, and you know, our people have passed. passed away, our ancestors, they would bury them right there on the spot. And so no matter where they try to put in these mines, lithium mine, copper mine, gold mine, whatever it may be, they have to understand that they're always going to be on sacred grounds. We were the first people here. And so I'm here to stand with Gary and the McDermott tribe to protect these sacred sites, these burial sites. We have the wildlife out here. We have the natural medicines that we use. And so, you know, just throughout the past few years, I just really put my heart into protecting the land, protecting the water.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Gary McKinney and Joshua Dean Sr. on protecting Pahima from the largest possible construction of an open pit lithium mine in the northwestern part of Nevada and the traditional territories of the Paiute, Shoshone, and surrounding nations peoples. And now back to the interview.
Myron Dewey is my older brother, and him and I, we did this stuff together. We first got into it at Standing Rock, and I saw the unity there of the people from around the world. So I want to continue that unity here in our backyard.
And do you guys mind sharing about what's happening with the in regard to the federal judge who's, for instance, the court, like I'm aware that the court rejected the evidence presented about, it was presented by the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, right? And the Burn Paiute tribe, that a massacre took place in the area. And this is, yeah, was including written records and eyewitnesses of accounts of federal soldiers massacring at least 31 Paiute men, women, and children at Thacker Pass. And this was in 1865. So can you guys talk about that a little bit, about the past and the fight now to make this an archaeological site, a cultural importance, or a traditional site and religious site for the Paiute people? Can either you or Gary get into that and let us know, educate us a little bit about that?
All right. What's going on now is, well, I want to, you know, talk to the listeners right now about a little thing called the 1872 General Mining Law. And there's a lot of heavy organizations that oppose it, that are calling for a reform of the 1872 mining law, because back then, you know, mind you, this was before electricity, before the light bulb. This was when donkeys, pickaxes, and shovels were, you know, mining in tunnels. And you fast forward 150 years down the road, we land in 2022, and we're letting that donkeys, pickaxes, and shovel 1872 mining law dictate how we move forward with electricity, electric vehicles, lithium batteries. And so there's a big reason right there. You can tell you know, why we oppose this, why there's organizations like the Great Basin Resource Watch that are, you know, have these mining companies under a microscope. And they better be on point, or else somebody's going to get sick. Some animals are going to get sick. You know, something's going to be broken out here. And so there's that on the one hand, 1872. And then you got 2022 now, where President Biden wants to rush through and call it the Defense Production Act. And after the prayer ride, you know, we finished up here, and I had to jump in my other car and drive over to Reno, pick up a rental, and then drive down to Peach Springs, Arizona. And I got there about 2 o'clock the next day, and it was for a lithium convergence meeting, Southwest convergence meeting. There we had representatives from the Oak Flats, the Apache Stronghold movement. They're fighting the copper mine down there in Apache territory. And then we have the Hualapai tribe, who's you know, they're the indigenous community on the front line fighting the same thing we are, lithium. And the same thing that they're doing down there is what they try to do up here. And been noticing that they're swapping methods and maneuvers, and you know, they want to rush through everything. They want to put a fast track on this lithium mine, Thacker Pass. They want to protect it with the Defense Production Act. Why? because they're scared of the people. Simple as that. They're scared that the people can come together and we can really oppose this thing. They want money and we want life. And that's pretty heavy if you ask me. So we've been doing everything we can to make sure we're opposing that in the public eye. You know, we've been releasing statements opposing the Defense Production Act because it might cut out the indigenous voices. They might fast track it to where they don't need to consult with anybody. It is that scary to us. You know, that's the fight that you won't hear about in the paper and in litigation, and you know that right there has a lot of weight. And so any one of these federally recognized tribes could jump on the lawsuit and claim that, you know, they're desecrating sacred sites out here, which they are. But, you know, we just don't know if there's an agreement between the tribal governments around here and Lithium America. So the Fort McDermitt Paiute Shoshone tribe, you know, we're wondering, are you in agreement with them? And if you are, you need to make it known. And if there isn't, you need to understand too, Fort McDermitt, that there's a lot of cultural significance that tie in the Western Shoshones, the Northern Paiutes, the Modocs, the Pitt River Paiutes, you know, the Pyramid Lake Paiutes, the Burns Paiutes, the Shoshone Bannocks, the Shoshone Paiutes from Duck Valley, and you know, there's these different colonies in between. But you know, we all have that traditional legacy of our warriors coming out. You know, we called them runners back in the day to go check on things, you know, and they say that, you know, that's not the way you're supposed to do it. And they say we won't win by doing so. So they want to fast track everything and shut us down. But with these interviews, with these discussions, keep on going, you know, that's what really is putting the fire underneath their butts is, you know, the people in asking those questions. You know, are you in agreement with them? Because you should know that you're selling out the tribal, the cultural history, the tribal history, and it's tied into the Northern Nevada history through the railroad. And you know, that's something that they're afraid of. And I'll tell you why. I got in contact, you know, recently with one of the National Historical Sites. Her name is Alexa Roberts. She's the former superintendent of the Sand Creek Massacre National Historical Site. And from our discussions, this is a legitimate place to claim as, you know, we could put a monument here. It's just, you know, jumping through the loops. And they're not letting us see the loops here. And so we're really feeling around in the dark. But, you know, we do believe in our ancestors' prayer that, you know, hey, these things are going to start happening to our people. And how are we going to continue? And that prayer was laid down a long time ago, and we never were told, you know, it was going to happen overnight, in a year, in a couple years, in their lifetime. But you know, it was said, and we find ourselves in those times. And you know, as long as we know our roots, where we came from, we're going to know where we're going. And there's a lot of people out here that can, you know, testify to that, you know, that we predate George Washington in the United States of America. And during the times when the United States of America was becoming the United States of America was the Civil War in the 1860 to 1865. They had 22 massacres out here in the West, and Thacker Pass, it went undocumented, but it falls on the 21st massacre. There was one other after that, and that's when the Civil War and everybody went their separate ways, and the gold rush was happening. And by that time, you know, they couldn't rush into the treaties and ratify them because, you know, the plots of land that they had set out for the Indians were being settled on. Fences were put up and family, you know, homesteading and whoop-de-whoop. And so that made it impossible for them to really justify those treaties. And we have treaties like the Boise Valley Treaty of 1864, and you have the 1866 Bruno Valley Treaty. And my great-great-grandfather is on those treaties. And so that's my big obligation here for being rooted to this ground. And, you know, because my people, my family, you know, my grandparents, their blood is laying out here. And it's up to us to, you know, spread that word and, you know, open people's eyes because they're lying to us with this green energy transition. Let's just go out and say it. You know, these are people who can't see the trees, the forest for the trees. You know, what they consider green is money, and what we see as green is grass. You know, that's paradise to us. That's being rich if we're able to be out in the mountains and not worry about anything. And it's when we go back to the cities and whatever, we have to plug back in, and we're back on a time clock, you know, up at 8, off of work at 5, and you know, it's stressful. And that's the kind of system that this lithium is going to feed into. And we need our young ones, our children, you know, to know that, you know, we hunt and we fish and we sing and we gather. And now is the time where we put our foot down and we make that possible by any means, you know, because we're losing sight of what it really is to be a human. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's us, you know, thinking simply and honoring Mother Earth instead of taking and taking and taking. You know, it's living in the old ways. You know, they're not dead yet, and as long as these roots are sprouting, as long as these streams are running, as long as these springs are still here, we have you know, Mother Earth under us, and she's looking after us. But it's when they take that away, us humans take away the springs and the streams, and you know, they leave us with the wasteland. How is that green, and how is that gonna help us people? How is that not gonna hurt us? You know, that's the real question. The, you know, are we living in reality, or are we gonna continue to be told that this is actually, that this is how it is? Actually, there's money to be made. Actually, this is the greenest way out of, you know, the climate crisis. But in reality, it's the capitalism, the colonialism, and the extractivism that's hurting everything. And we can't ask ourselves why. You know, if we understand and we respect each other and we honor life, you know, we're going to see different.
And that concludes the first segment of our program today here on American Indian Airwaves. We were speaking with Gary McKinney and Joshua Dean Sr. of the People of the Red Mountain, an indigenous-led organization to protect Pahimaha from the Thacker Pass lithium mine. This segment was conducted by guest interviewee Irene Montoyas, and the organization, the People of the Red Mountain, are having an action on April 24th in Idlewild Park in Reno, Nevada, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, you can visit the People of the Red Mountain website at peopleoftheredmountain.com. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Who died along the way. To those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people. To those who left their communities by force or by choice, and through generations no longer know who they are. To those who search and never find. To those that turn away the so-called non-accepted. To those that bring us together. And to those living outside, keeping touch, the voice for many.
To those that make it back to live and fight the struggles of their people. To those that give up and those who do not care. To those who abuse themselves and others. And those who revive again. To those who are physically, mentally, or spiritually incapable by accident or by birth. To those who seek strength in our spirituality and ways of life, and those who exploit it, even our own. To those who fall for the lies and join the dividing lines that keep us fighting amongst each other.
To the outsiders who step in, good or bad, and those of us who don't know better. To the leaders and prisoners of war, politics, crime, race, and religion, innocent or guilty.
To the young, the old, the living, and the dead. To our brothers and sisters and all living things across Mother Earth,
and her beauty we've destroyed and denied the honor that the Creator has given each individual.
The truth that lies in our hearts, all my relations.
All Our Relations by Eulalie, here on American Indian Airwaves. In the final segment of today's program here on American Indian Airwaves, I have the honor and pleasure to speak with one of the leading indigenous scientists who worked on the recently published IPCC 6 assessment report for the Working Group 2 titled Climate Change 2022, Impacts, Adaptations, and Vulnerability, which was published this past February of 2022. In looking at the history of the IPCC, starting back in 1988, Indigenous voices were excluded for almost 16 plus years. The fact that Indigenous peoples are working and contributing to the IPCC's assessment reports is a relatively new phenomena, and I have the honor and pleasure to speak with Nikki Cooley from the Dene Nation. She's co-manager of Tribes and Climate Change Program and the interim assistant director for the Institute for Tribal Environmental Professionals out of Northern Arizona University. She is one of several Indigenous peoples that worked on the IPCC's sixth assessment report that was published earlier this year. This is Nikki Cooley on Climate Change 2022, Impacts, Adaptations, and Vulnerability in our continuing conversation on protecting Mother Earth.
My first experience in contributing to any of these high-level reports such as the IPCC, and it was most likely granted through the existence of the Status of Tribes and Climate Change report, the STAC report that ITEP released in August 2021. And so that kind of, we worked with a couple of the authors that then connected us with one of the lead authors for the North American Chapter 14. And we just kind of got all these folks together that were well-versed with working with Native tribes, Indigenous tribes, and climate change adaptation or mitigation planning, including Indigenous knowledges and whatnot. So that's kind of how that came about, and that was really a great experience. Writing these reports is never simple. There's a lot of going back and forth, lots of emails, lots of reviews, and kind of really, you really don't get to write a whole paragraph or a whole page. You are inserting yourself into other people's work, you know, so, and then how you combine that, it's kind of like magic, you know, and that really speaks to how well your team works together. So we were very lucky that we had, you know, Kyle White from the University of Michigan helping kind of shepherd the process, along with Sherry Lee Harper from Canada, and there's another person from Canada too, but yeah, those folks really helped kind of push that along. So we were very excited to be part of the report because, as you mentioned, the IPCC report plus other national global reports often leave out the Indigenous voices. It doesn't matter what continent they're from, right. But I feel like it's just an afterthought after the reports are published and people raise their concerns and frustrations. Or, yeah, and we've always been an afterthought. So for us to be largely mentioned and included in this report is a small victory.
Well, thank you for that. And I know in the past I had the honor and pleasure to interview Dr. Daniel Wildcat back in March of 2014. And part of that, our conversation in the interview back then was how Indigenous peoples were, I guess, allowed, if you will, or permitted to participate in the production of the fifth assessment report by the IPCC. And just given, you know, the history of the IPCC being established back in, you know, 1988 by the United Nations Environmental Program and the World Meteorological Organization, I was curious, and when it comes to Indigenous worldviews and philosophies and in trying to or in articulating, I guess, and I know Kyle's written about this, right, the contemporary or this generation's notion of the climate crisis for Indigenous peoples. And I think, you know, Kyle's written and others talk about for Indigenous peoples, right, we have faced generations of forms of climate crisis, if you will. And what are some of the, I guess, the struggles, right, between expressing Indigenous science or indigenous epistemologies perspectives in this report, and how that is placed in conversation, if you will, in this kind of Western European framework of this scientific document?
You know, we had the section I worked on was pretty, you know, small.
Okay.
But, you know, small in the sense that we weren't part of the entire report. Okay. We're part of the Indigenous Peoples section. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, because we were very much encouraged to talk about the climate impacts on our people, on our foods, and our non-human relatives. It wasn't, I didn't find any opposition or questioning mm-hmm. of what we wrote, which was surprising. I think our counterpart from Canada, who helped push this along, was very mm-hmm. much encouraging us to really talk openly about the impacts, and to kind of back that up with examples, which we have hundreds of examples, mm-hmm. References, citations, and whatnot. And that's kind of rare, because I have encountered, whether it's writing a paper or a presentation, webinar, what have you, that there is always some type of pushback or some sort of pushback on Indigenous knowledges, only because they don't, the opposing party often doesn't understand, or there's not numbers assigned, there's no graph, and it's hearsay. So they kind of, the Western scientists, non-Indigenous scientists or researchers, policymakers often object to the qualitative aspect of, you know, climate change impacts. And mm-hmm. you will have read that the IPCC, whatever it says about Indigenous impacts, is no big surprise to Indigenous peoples. We've been saying it for a long time. But Western scientists, or the Western world, finally getting the hang of it. They're allowing themselves to listen and try to understand what we're saying. This is part of my whole work, my life's work, right? Indigenous knowledges. And I personally experienced the effects of this rapidly changing climate and its impacts every summer. There's already a fire in New Mexico in its early April. So with this report, we were very much encouraged to push our agenda in getting the word out about Indigenous impacts. So, and that's rare. It's very rare for that to happen.
What are some of the key takeaways from this report in terms of the work that you did and other Indigenous folks that participated?
Indigenous knowledges is science. It's an accepted form of science for understanding past, current, and future climate impacts to the environment, to the humans, to the non-human relatives, the wildlife and the plants. So I thought that was a big message that they put very high confidence in that. But also this Indigenous knowledge and science that's data that confirms these adaptation actions or strategies are valuable information for other communities to adapt or to use themselves. And this is based on hundreds and hundreds of years of adaptation strategies, and they're still being used today by Indigenous communities. And there's examples out there of what tribes have been doing and how it's being documented, and you know what they're doing now. It hasn't changed, right? The message has always been the same, that we know what we're talking about, and because we know what we're talking about, because we've seen it, we've felt it, we've experienced it. And it's time that people listen and not just talk about the disproportionate unique impacts on tribal communities because of their location and how there were sovereign nations that we're very much an adaptable society. And so that's a big theme in this report that I really, really appreciate it that they put in there. So
Hello, thank you for that. When I'm listening to you, there's just, you know, for all of us Indigenous peoples, wherever we are, Mother Earth, there's so many shared and yet similar struggles and yet different struggles. So like, you know, back home in the Southeast, you know, we have a legacy of the lumber industry. We have a legacy of chemical operations. We have the state in North Carolina with the largest factory farm poultry industries, and you know, and we continue to see the ocean waters rising, what people know as hurricanes being more severe, and of course through a cultural lens that has a whole different meaning. And then, you know, like for back home, you know, for you and struggles that we've covered regarding the Dene Nation, that legacy of uranium mining, right, water, forced relocation, you know, a litany of afflictions. It goes on. And of course, if we move to other places on Mother Earth, you know, we can unpack all these different struggles and these pockets of resistance, and how Indigenous peoples are, their ability to adapt and their vitality brings us to where we are today. So how are you able to include all of these different struggles in one report? Or did folks just speak to common themes, if you will?
We spoke to kind of like the overriding common themes that we found were very much applicable to any Indigenous community across the globe, because we were very careful not to represent, you know, a region or a specific tribe. So we were careful. That's something that's just common practice with in the work that we do, because we work with so many different communities. And so it's nice to have a lot of folks working with different tribes, Indigenous communities across the globe, that could speak to that, you know, kind of gathering the commonality that we had that Indigenous peoples have and are experiencing from climate change impact. So yes, so it's just kind of the overriding themes. And if anybody would read this report, they would identify with what it's saying, like, yes, that's happening in my community. Yes, that is how I feel. Yes, that is what we are struggling with, or that's what we have done. Similar things that we have done. So, yeah.
And I was curious, in the report, does COVID-19 and how it's impacted Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations, is that part of this report or preliminary work of the report done at a time where COVID was just beginning, if you will?
For the section that we did, we literally worked on it a couple months before it was published and whatnot. So I don't think we really made that a big part of our portion of it. Mm-hmm. And it may be mentioned just a little bit in other sections, but yeah, so we didn't, I think we do mention it a little bit, but yeah, it was happening at a time where most of it was written where I don't think they really mentioned it. I'll just say that. Yeah, it wasn't part of our section, and we weren't, and we should have. I mean, part of our, we talk about the health impact, so.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to, because just so many Indigenous peoples or Native American peoples, right, as I'm sure you can personally testify to, and I know just the folks, you know, we've talked to during COVID, just so many various adverse impacts, right, with COVID. And of course, you know, that changes. It certainly can have a profound influence on our strategies moving forward, right? Part of that adaptability mm-hmm. that you're talking about, right? These proactive responses to the climate crisis, but also synergistically compounded with the effects of COVID. And that's kind of coming back to my earlier question about, you know, these cultural differences between Western science and Indigenous sciences is in the report. And I don't know if it's just because this isn't the place for the report or if it's intentionally left out, but the implications of these intergenerational compounded effects of the climate crisis, you know, for some Indigenous nations has resulted in forced relocation. And some mm-hmm. folks are doing that right now. And as you know, as place-based peoples, as you know, I always just say, or kind of in summary, right? No land, no language, no cultural life in terms of intergenerational forms of cultural transmission. And does the report mm-hmm. speak to that? And if so, how? Or if not, how come?
The intergenerational teachings and also the loss of, I guess, the teachings, it is mentioned a little bit in there, kind of yeah. using Swinomish and mm-hmm. some other communities. But yeah, not a lot. I don't think it was intentionally, I hope I'm answering your question yeah. correctly. I don't think it was intentionally left out. Mm-hmm. But we do kind of mention that a little bit.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves, and we're speaking with one of the Indigenous scientists, Nikki Cooley, who worked on the IPCC 6 Assessment Report, Working Group 2, titled Climate Change 2022, Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability. And now back to the interview. The reason why I was asking that, because when we talk about climate change, right, man-made cause, for most folks, they believe that, right? And a lot of this is done by settler colonists, right? Major industries, the oil and natural gas industries, and as well as many other contributory industries. But yet we don't talk about the complicity of how the climate crisis results in a form of genocide, if you will, perpetrated against Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations. And so I guess that idea that, you know, the effects of the climate crisis for some Indigenous peoples could be construed as an act or as a form of genocide. And I'm not sure if those kind of conversations came up in the process, or is it just strictly sticking to kind of the cause and effects, if you will, and the proactive responses by Indigenous peoples?
Well, I mean, the report does mention how climate change impacts the livelihoods.
Gotcha.
And also the economics of the tribe, and that, you know, you can tie that back to their subsistence and gathering and ceremonial practices, and that is definitely mentioned in there, and how that's really closely tied to the physical, spiritual, mental health of Indigenous people. So that is definitely mentioned actually pretty broadly in here in the Indigenous people section. So, and how different that the health concerns can be from the larger urban communities, or even just the larger society, how they think of health impacts. Mm. Whereas Indigenous peoples, the report mentions how the impacts really affect not only humans, but their close relationship to the environment and to the non-human relatives. So in that context is how we kind of talked about it. So the climate change impacts has a domino effect on the livelihoods, and that a part of our livelihoods, right, is with our ceremonies and our prayer, subsistence and gathering practices, and that is equated to our health. Mm. And not just the human, not just the five-fingered beings, right, but all the other beings, the wildlife and the plants. Mm. The air and the water and so on. So that's definitely mentioned in here. So,
Nikki, when we talk about resiliency strategies in some of the work that you and others have done, talk about some of what those resiliency strategies look like. Because I know, like in the Northwest, right, Indigenous peoples in the Northwest are talking and communicating with Indigenous peoples south of them as plant and animal relations are migrating northerly. So as part of that conversation, right, it is figuring out, as Mother Earth changes, how to be culturally sustainable for future generations. So what are some of those resiliency strategies look like?
Oh gosh, there's so many great examples. I think the top one might be that they are relying or referencing Indigenous knowledges of their community, mm-hmm. and involving elders, youth, and people of all ages that have that knowledge that can contribute to an adaptation strategy. For example, indigenous knowledges, you can look to the Blackfeet tribe, who has released an adaptation plan, I think, in 2018. Mm-hmm. And they their adaptation plan mentions beaver habitat restoration. And that's a hot topic now across the country. But again, they and other tribes have been saying that beavers help maintain and can restore the riparian habitat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you hear on NPR almost every other week, whatever station, national or local, that beaver habitats are less prone to the severity or intensities of wildfires, just because they're very much managed very well by the beavers. So that's kind of an example of indigenous knowledges. Using that knowledge is an adaptation strategy. But also, as you mentioned, like the co-management of resources, mm-hmm. tribes are looking to their neighbors, indigenous or non-indigenous, to co-manage resources. I could give an example. Maybe the Nez Perce is trying to work with farmers on non-tribal lands to kind of do riparian fish habitat restoration projects. I know that's kind of in the beginnings of it, but at least they're talking. Right. So that communication and multi-jurisdictional co-management of resources is now a highly recommended adaptation strategy. So, because, like you said, you know, our resources, our relatives move because they no longer have water, access to adequate water or food resources, or it's too warm for them, so they move where it's cooler. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really prompting communities to work better together. So those are a couple examples that I can give.
In regards to both reports, you know, we have a lot of both indigenous and we have non-indigenous listeners out there. And you and I have been talking about the work that yourself and other colleagues and your contributions in these both of these reports. And, you know, with the climate crisis, as most people come to understand it as or call it, you know, and we look at, you know, the loss of biodiversity, the economic dire straits that people are in, COVID, and all these other manifested violent forms of settler colonialism. And when we come back to, you know, trying to heal Mother Earth, you know, and the fact that we're such small numbers and the larger scale of the five-fingered, as you said, what are some of your concerns that you see with just from your vantage point, you know, as a community member, you know, as a professor, as somebody who's worked on, you know, these major reports? What are the things that you see are crucial that we need to focus on?
In the context of in the context of indigenous communities responding or addressing climate change impacts, I think, and I'll reference the STAC report, and this was long, I thought about this long before the STAC report originated or came to fruition, is that, you know, we have to take a holistic view, again, of how we approach the care of our environment and whatnot. A holistic approach that combines or balances traditional indigenous knowledges with the Western non-indigenous knowledge system, and how that they can be combined to work together rather than competing or fighting each other. There's no reason for that. Indigenous peoples, we have been very much addressing different impacts, whether it's forced assimilation, removal, boarding school, trauma, everything. But now we have climate change that we have always, we're very adaptable in every sense, at everything that's been thrown at our people. So yeah, a holistic approach. And that also means that you honor the gender roles of your community members of your tribe. Mm. And the IPCC report also mentions how, you know, indigenous peoples from different ages, backgrounds, genders, they have varying impacts on those people as an individual and as a whole group, as humans. So we all have our own roles as two-spirit, male or female. And then I think the second thing would be that tribal nations were sovereign nations, and we have the rights and the ability to, you know, self-determine, you know, self-govern ourselves, and recognizing that long existed and it still exists today, and that there again, the holistic approach and the need for that approach to work together.
Nikki, in wrapping up our conversation, what is your message to the youth on being good ancestors?
As a Navajo woman, Indigenous woman who grew up and still lives part-time on the Nebekeya Navajo lands, I grew up without electricity, I grew up without running water, I grew up butchering our own foods, harvesting from the cornfield, herding sheep, riding horses bareback for hours or even for days, and having that intimate relationship really helps guide my work, my professional life, but also my personal life, and my spirituality, my mental, physical health. And there's a lot of our young relatives who do not have that intimate relationship with the earth like I had the privilege of having. They don't have that yet, but it can be reconnected if they should choose to follow that journey. And I'm going to say to you, all you young people, your journey was laid out long before you were born or growing in your mother's womb. Your journey was laid out, and it's up to you to complete that journey as your ancestors intended. And what they intended literally was for you to survive and be strong and confident. And, you know, part of that is taking care of yourself, but also the environment. You're very much tied to it. And I'll end with this. You know, my umbilical cord is buried in a sheep corral at my grandmother's home. And so that maintains that innate, intimate connection to the earth. And, you know, you don't have to, bury your umbilical cord. I don't know where your kids' umbilical cords are buried, but you have some tie to the environment where we have that intimate relationship. So I would encourage all the young people to just maintain their strength and remember our ancestors survived so we could be here, so you could continue to be a good relative as they intended.
The moment of silence is over.
And that was Nikki Cooley from the Diné Nation. She's one of several Indigenous scientists that worked on the recently published IPCC 6 Assessment Report that was released in February of 2022. And that wraps up our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to Gary McKinney, Joshua Sneen Sr., Nikki Cooley. A special thank you to our musical guest, Aragon Star, Kupa Aina, Ulali, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studio of Burnt Swamp Studio in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
The moment of silence is over. Justify why your freedom manifests on their graves, and the blood never comes clean from the guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains. In a rhythm of resistance, we still fight for our lives. In this war that never we
race against our fears. Try not to become what we've endured, wearing our souls on the thread. The moment of silence is over.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
This is Joseph Galvan. I'm your host for Art Focus. KBOO Community Radio is only possible with your support, so join the party and contribute at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. That's kboo.fm/give, or you can just text KBOO to the number 44321. Thanks a lot.
Andy Warhol, let's scream. Andy!